it's time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
Hello, and welcome to Capital Thinking. This is Deborah Lodge. I am not Kevin O'Neill. I am standing in for Kevin O'Neill, and we have a wonderful program this morning. Our lineup today, first, Norma Cram and Mel Gates will discuss the two very significant big data reports recently issued by various government entities, both the White House Big Data Report and the PCAST report. Then Frank Smolis is going to give us an update on international trade negotiations and specifically some new negotiations on environmental goods. And following that, Josh Green is going to give us some updates on energy issues, including clean tech and O-Power. So please stay tuned and remember that Capital Thinking is on Twitter and you can follow the show before, during, and after each episode. So first, I would like to discuss the big data reports with Norma Cram and Mel Gates. By way of background, Norma is in the Pattenbogg's D.C. office, where she is co-chair of the firm's Homeland Security, Defense, and Technology Transfer Practice Groups. She focuses on key policy issues, including cybersecurity, homeland security, defense, and many issues relating to critical infrastructure. And Mel is an associate in our Denver office, where she counsels clients on data privacy, cybersecurity, and regulatory compliance issues. Mel is a certified information privacy professional, and she holds that certification from the International Association of Privacy Professionals. I am delighted that I work with both of these ladies, and so happy that you can be here with us today.
Thanks, Deborah.
Great. Well, big data certainly has been a big focus in Washington this month, with both the White House and the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology, or PCAST for short, issuing reports on big data. Norma and Mel, I look forward to your discussion on these reports and what they signal from both a policy and regulatory perspective. So, delving in, Norma, the White House report certainly is significant, but it clearly did not come out of the blue. What was the real driver for this report?
Thanks, Deborah, and thanks for having me on the show today. You're right. The report clearly did not come out of the blue, and honestly, it wasn't happenstance that the President announced the creation of this task force and report during a speech that he gave at the Justice Department earlier in the year, where he was focusing on reforming the U.S.'s intelligence practices. Now, this is not the focus of the report, but the context for understanding why the report was ultimately put out, I think, is important. And ultimately, there are many concerns that consumers have, and rightly so, about what the NSA has been doing, Snowden leaks. And I think the administration understood that they needed to very, very clearly state that our values, their values, dictate that privacy is very, very important to all of us, and that the government needs to do more to help protect it, and as do companies. As they inevitably sell more products, potentially in solutions that consumers buy, consumers need to know that they understand as well that privacy is key. And look, ultimately, I feel like we can't turn around any day with the never-ending cybersecurity attacks where we see that consumer data is being deliberately stolen. Could be Target, could be Neiman Marcus, it could be Wyndham Hotels. At the end of the day, I think consumers are expecting the government needs to step up and demonstrate that they can help make sure the data is protected, even if that means potentially more standards, more requirements. But we'll go through that in more detail.
Great points. And Mel, you know, before we get into the reports themselves, you know, they are both on, quote, big data. What can you give us, you know, some insights? I mean, what do they mean by big data? And, you know, why should we be concerned about it?
Well, thanks, Deborah. And it's always great to join you on Capital Thinking. You know, when we think of big data, I think it begs the question of how is this different than small data? And that may sound almost laughable, but it's worth thinking about. And databases that we've grown accustomed to, for instance, when I as a consumer interact with a particular organization, whether it's my bank or my healthcare provider or an educational institution, that particular database and that one particular set of data, very traditional, typical databases. Big data is a little bit different from those typical databases, and it's really called out by three different things, and it's called the three V's: volume, velocity, and variety. So what does that mean? Well, first off, volume. Big data, it's called that for a reason. Volume means just the sheer level of data that we're talking about. You know, in the past, we've talked about megabytes and terabytes. Well, now we're talking about things called zettabytes, you know, enormous amounts of data, very large databases. Velocity means that the data comes into these environments with enormous speed and regularity. So it's data that's constantly being updated. And then variety means it's a lot of different kinds of data. So what are some examples of that? It may be data that's collected or integrated amongst many different organizations' databases or databases within a group. Also very important to keep in mind that big data includes something called the Internet of Things. And as we increasingly have more sensors and monitors in our environment, whether it's an internet-connected refrigerator that keeps up with my grocery shopping, or the surveillance cameras and sensors in large cities, all of these kinds of things are creating constant flows of data. All of those are collected together for analysis, and that entire environment is something that we think of now as big data.
Well, that's very helpful, and I know that, you know, there is such business in terms of analyzing the big data and trying to, you know, target or draw some information out of it. So it certainly is a horizon for government to get involved in it in this way. But Norma, turning back to you and the White House report, what specifically does it address, and why is the White House report so important?
Thank you, Deborah. And I think one of Mel's points is really important. The White House report attempts to define really what is big data, because as Mel said, it is a very different and challenging issue, and it runs across many sectors, public and private. So the report attempts to run through and define it, as Mel just explained. It attempts to explain what the administration's approach to open data and privacy means, and that is something that they have really ratcheted up over the last few years. And then it delves into different aspects of data. We have public sector management of data, things that people tend to be very used to in the healthcare setting. We have the issues related to big data in education, and that's where we get into real concerns about our kids and privacy issues, because that's not something that they tend to pay as much attention to. Then we look at what happens and how big data is managed in the homeland security environment and law enforcement. Those are really important issues because we know that big data really helps Homeland Security and law enforcement officials find terrorists, protect the American public. It actually helps identify human traffickers and other things. But you have to be careful with what you're doing with that data. Then it actually lays out what they think the private sector should do in managing their data. And that does speak, I think, to some of the concerns that we've seen and really the lack of real protections, whether it's in the banking industry, whether it's in the retail industry. We've seen big cyber attacks, even at the University of Maryland, close to home to us. And then, again, it lays out something that's really important. It talks about preserving privacy values. And that may seem like an overstated point, but it's not. We all have an expectation that the government is not going to be peering into our houses. We also assume and would hope, you know, we don't want Google driving by our houses and stealing data as well. But I think it's a very good foundational document that lays out core principles, public and private. And then honestly for me, I know we'll talk about this more, it's about what do each of these entities who are responsible for data do. And so I'd absolutely applaud the report, but I think the follow-on in the next few months could actually be more important. But I'll pause there.
And that's a good point. Mel, you know, turning to the PCAST report, is the timing of this odd? And, you know, who is PCAST? And, you know, what was their role in this analysis of big data?
Well, PCAST is the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology. And I think when you look at the kinds of statements in the report, it's important to know who that group of people are. And these are some very visible, very experienced experts in the technology arena. They include people from very large technology organizations and companies like Microsoft and Google and United Technologies. They're also representatives of venture capital groups that we think of in the Silicon Valley environment and what we think of as the tech community here, as well as some very prominent academic players and researchers who've looked at these kinds of issues for an extended period of time. And so the PCAST report and the role here is really more to talk about the underlying technologies, how they're changing from what we think of in terms of data and data privacy and the consumer's role, and really to support some of the policy decisions or issues that are addressed in the White House report that Norma talked about. I think one of the most interesting things about the PCAST report is also when you think of those folks I just talked about, they're in a position to perhaps make some bolder statements about the implications of big data and how privacy may be changing. And we really see that in the PCAST report, especially around their discussions on de-identification and data collection, as well as how the whole notice and consent model of privacy may be changing.
That's great. Let's talk about the de-identified data, because it seems to me that one sort of fallback of, you know, many sort of privacy policies that I've reviewed as a consumer, you know, and attorney, give assurances, oh, we never, you know, utilize or we never give to third parties any, you know, identifiable data. It can't be traced to you. However, we reserve the right to, you know, analyze this and share it in de-identified form. And I note that that's now a big issue. Can you discuss that and why that's important?
Well, in the context of big data, we really have to rethink what de-identification means, because, again, in the past, we've thought about those databases where I contribute as a consumer data to a particular organization and it's associated with my name. In those kinds of small environments, you could remove my name, you could remove other data fields, and perhaps make it more difficult to identify me. In the big data context, because now we're talking about this data from the Internet of Things and sensors that talk about things like location, environmental status, where my car has been, what my buying preferences might be. Even if my name and direct identifiers aren't attached to that, researchers have shown that by putting these different pieces of data together, it's much easier to point to a particular individual. So in other words, the whole concept of de-identification and anonymization that served us for a long time in the privacy world is starting to break down in this environment. And as Norma mentioned, the cybersecurity issues, as that concept of de-identification breaks down, becomes more worrisome.
And Norma, you know, I know that you mentioned some of the, you know, recent problems that have been occurring in terms of data breach and all. And, you know, in the context of the White House report and this other, I mean, do you see the change from, you know, it's okay to share, you know, data that is de-identified versus, you know, really tracing back? Is that a concern that the White House is voicing as well?
You know, it absolutely is. And there is this great intersection between what we talk about in this report, big data, privacy, cyber, and these issues. When we think about really what's happening, you have so much open source data that is being collected. People are saying, companies say, even the government is saying, we are de-identifying, we're taking out all the personal information when we share it. And ultimately, that may be true, but those who are smart enough to de-identify data are also the ones that are smart enough to figure out how to re-identify. And that's really where we get into great concerns. But there are different buckets. So the White House is very much concerned about data security overall. In 2011, they actually issued and sent up to the Congress very specific data security legislation. I know that was mentioned in the report. And now you have probably, I'd say, 10 to 15 pending bills in the Congress that are data security, data breach, you know, cyber-related, to talk about additional protections. And the nature and the scope of how you protect the data seems to be still under debate, at least within the Congress. Who, if there's a breach, you should be reporting information to, that becomes up in the air. And then you have questions like, should the Securities and Exchange Commission actually mandate or require companies to talk and disclose cybersecurity risks? And that becomes almost a two parallel tracks. One is that they believe that if companies are actually publicly stating the cybersecurity risks that they believe that their company has, that's important data for consumers to make decisions. Do you want to work with that company or do you not? Others debate whether or not that just is helping the bad guys better understand who is more vulnerable. But ultimately, I think the discussion about big data and the Internet of Things may have to come down to choice. All of these things provide greater efficiencies to us. They help make our lives easier. But at the end of the day, right now you're giving up a lot of information for that type of efficiencies. And while some people say whether it's the efficiency or even the security aspect that you have to choose, I may be one of the few folks left standing to say that I don't think that's true. These are hard issues, but it just means people have to work harder to provide the protections. It doesn't mean you necessarily have to give up 100% of either.
And that actually is a great lead-in to my next question, where, you know, our current privacy policy practices has focused quite significantly on choice and notice and consent, on the theory that, you know, consumers can give, you know, directions and either decide to opt in or not. Mel, how does the big data issue impact that policy? And what do the experts suggest, you know, pursuant to the PCAST report and, you know, sort of other movements?
Well, that's a great question, Deborah, because this whole question of notice and consent and consumer choice was really one of the big emphasis areas in the PCAST report. And, you know, back to this concept of traditional databases and what we now think of as small data, it's very easy to interact with a consumer when you're an individual organization collecting data for a specific purpose. You can provide notice to consumers, and they can choose whether or not to be involved in that. Now, there's a catch there in today's world, and that's something that experts really emphasized, and that's how do we do notice and consent today? And frankly, the way it typically happens is in these very long privacy policies that very clearly are written by lawyers most of the time, and very few people read them. And that's sort of the elephant in the room in these conversations. And one of the bold statements that the PCAST report made was saying, look, folks, this just really isn't reality to say that we have actual notice and consent going on even in today's world, because no one reads these things. In fact, they even use the term market failure to say that notice and consent isn't really working in today's world. Now take that into big data and it becomes even more difficult, because the whole idea behind big data is to look for novel ways to solve problems and, as Norma said, make life easier for us through interesting new ways of looking at data. If I'm doing that kind of analytics and novel uses of data, how can I possibly tell a consumer up front, here's what I'm going to do with your data, and do you agree to that or not? And so this whole traditional concept of noticing consent starts to break down, and instead we need to think more about, as the PCAST experts said, not just how is data collected, but how is data used? And they put a very strong emphasis on use. But of course, this starts to beg the question of how do consumers get involved in that kind of world?
Exactly. And how do the consumers maintain some control over, you know, what data is used? And I guess the next question I have in terms of that is, you know, I know that there has been quite a bit of effort, particularly in the FTC side and some others, in terms of do not track concepts and legislation. And how does that is that contrary to these reports or the suggestions, or is that consistent with them? Mel, I'd like to hear your views on that first, and then Norma, if you have comments, please add.
Well, I think you see in all of these kinds of issues, as you point out, whether it's do not track and some of the things that the FTC is looking at, or these challenges in big data that we see in these reports, we're all looking at how can we do a better job as an environment and a culture of helping people to understand their choices and make simple choices. One of the interesting ideas that the PCAST report suggests is to maybe take this to a different kind of market-based approach, and that would be to create something they call privacy profiles, where an individual consumer, rather than reviewing each one of these organizations' detailed policies and making a choice, would instead review profiles or approaches, maybe even think of it as philosophies that various trusted organizations might describe. And then those sorts of profiles would be applied to particular apps or other things that they might use. And so the consumer would then be able to say, you know, perhaps I'm someone who's very interested in data that is used in a way to empower consumers. And so perhaps my privacy profile would allow sharing based on that idea. But again, this still begs the question of what does it mean to collect data and how might we use it? But that concept of profiles might be a good way for the software development and app market to make it easier for consumers to make these choices.
Good point. And Norma, what's your view on that particular aspect of this, both of these reports?
You know, just a couple of quick thoughts to build on what Nell said. There was one line at this point, somewhere between the White House report and the PCAST report, that talks about the disclosure statements that are included by some companies. As Mel rightly said, they're written by lawyers. As I like to say, they're not even written in English. It's a font, you know, number 7. And the fact that, you know, while the disclosure is provided to people, it's not easy for them to find or read or understand. And if we look back or think back to the global financial crisis and the banking issues, one of the things where we see a very similar analogy was the need to create the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Ultimately, at the end of the day, whether it was the banks or the credit card companies, you know, they are now directed to make clear disclosures that are easy for consumers to understand. They, in some cases, they limit how long the disclosures can be. And I think as we go into this broader environment of the Internet of Things and worrying about big data, we should take some of the lessons learned from that and apply it to the broader consumer space. We don't need to recreate the wheel, but we do need to make sure that consumers understand what they're getting into. And because, again, in the open source environment, companies can collect as much information on you as they want right now, and you may not know. On the FTC, I think the Federal Trade Commission is doing a great job pursuing consumer rights. We've seen cases like against Wyndham Hotels, where Wyndham Hotels had 3 very severe cyber breaches, and the FTC is alleging that they did not take proper action. You think about the retail industry, everyone goes online to purchase something. You're giving up lots of information, and you just assume it's going to be protected. And so I think there does need to be a better environment that's more streamlined, that enables consumers to understand what are you giving up, what does it mean, and then what are your risks? And then ultimately, consumers will have to make some of those decisions. But they, you know, if you don't have the information, how are you ever going to know?
Exactly. And Norma, do you expect that these reports are going to spur additional legislation in Congress?
I think that these reports, they could certainly spur additional legislation. I think they actually provide a really solid foundation to some of the pending bills, and that includes the data security bills on the Hill. It's probably more likely we could see some of those bills passed this year, which would give consumers more rights. And when we get into that de-identification issue, I know we're running out of time, when we talk about cybersecurity information sharing, it's about tracking where some of these attacks are coming from, but that means companies do have to identify individuals, but there's a bill to talk about greater cyber information sharing. You just have to make sure that the consumer's information is protected in that case, because at times you'll have a terrorist, a hacktivist, who will assume someone else's identity using their email address and other personal data to attack a system, and that's something you have to be really careful about.
Yeah, and that is something that we expect, you know, everyone wants to take care of and be careful about. Before we run out of time totally, Norma, how would someone contact you if they wanted more information about, you know, all the areas that you work in, critical infrastructure and what's going on the Hill and other aspects of this security and cybersecurity area?
Sure. They can reach me online at nkraym@pamboggs.com or via our office, which is 202-457-6000.
Great. And Mel, how would someone contact you if they wanted to get additional information relating to all the wonderful areas of your expertise?
You can reach me on email is probably the easiest way, and that's at mgates@pattenboggs.com.
Excellent. I do hope everyone will stay tuned for our next segment. Frank Smolis is going to come and give us additional updates relating to issues of foreign trade. If we have two more minutes on the privacy and data security part, Mel, I would like to ask you, what is the impact of these reports on the counseling perspective? Should companies start revising their privacy policies and practices, or is it a wait-and-see attitude?
Well, I think it's a combination of those two things. I mean, organizations always need to be looking at what kind of data they collect, how they're contemplating using it, and what kinds of promises that they've made to consumers. With the sorts of cases that Norma mentioned in Federal Trade Commission enforcement, a lot of those have been because companies just didn't keep the promises they made. So part of it is thinking that way. Another part is making sure that the technical staff and people that are developing these products and databases and data collectors are really sensitive to these issues and understand that the way we think about privacy as a culture is very much evolving right now.
Exactly. Well, thank you very much. I think we need to cut off now for the next segment, and I really appreciate your being on Capital Thinking today.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Now you don't have to stay linked to your desktop or laptop. Take Voice America on the go and listen anywhere. Get our mobile app for iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android at the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hey, out of my way!
Welcome to Washington Gridlock. Patton Boggs' legal team can make sense of it all. We know how Washington works. We've been sorting it out for over 50 years. We have what it takes. Straight, unfiltered, Patton Boggs. We deliver the insights you need to stay on top of your game.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs. Straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs. A bipartisan voice with knowledge and over 50 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has over 50 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than five decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Now you don't have to stay linked to your desktop or laptop. Take Voice America on the go and listen anywhere. Get our mobile app for iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android at the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
Hello, this is Deborah Lodge, and welcome back to Capital Thinking. As you know, I am standing in today for Kevin O'Neill, and I am pleased to start the next segment of our show featuring Frank Simolis. Frank is a partner in the Patton Boggs D.C. office, where he is co-chair of our international trade practice. Frank advises clients on many matters, including trade law, trade policy and legislation, and international trade negotiations. And today, Frank is going to give us some updates on various trade negotiations that the U.S. is currently involved in, and discuss as well a new WTO negotiation regarding trade in environmental goods. So welcome back, Frank. I'm so happy that you're here.
Great. Thank you, Deborah. Good to chat with you again.
Yes, and I look forward to updates from the last time that you were on the show, and I had the honor of standing in for Kevin. I know that then you were discussing, you know, the meeting in Vietnam and other things that were, you know, going on or about to take place. And I know that May is a very busy month for TPP negotiations, and I wonder if you could give us an update on some of the latest developments.
Sure. Happy to, Deborah. Last time we spoke, I believe that there were talks underway. There's now a new round of discussions. There's a big ministerial, which is coming up in Singapore. That'll be the 19th and 20th of next week. But as preparation for that ministerial, the TPP negotiators are once again back in Ho Chi Minh City talking about various issues yet to be resolved. This is the same week, Deborah, that the U.S.-EU negotiators are going to be meeting here in Washington for their latest round of the EU trade negotiations. So there's a lot of sound and fury, a lot of meetings, but very low expectations. In fact, it's a little bit unusual that the negotiators, USTR Mike Froman, for example, has said this is really sort of a stock-taking session. We're going to sort of assess where we are and don't expect any major breakthroughs, at least as far as the TPP talks are concerned.
Interesting. And, you know, what are some of the issues that are holding up the talks then? And the, I guess that's on the TTIP front, right?
Right. Well, let me go back to TPP. This is very confusing with all these acronyms.
Thank you. Yeah,
I got thrown off by
some of these acronyms. Yes,
right.
Please
right.
go
by
back TPP, to the TPP.
Trans-Pacific Partnership. 14 countries, 40% of the world's GDP. Latest entrant being discussed is Japan. That's obstacle number one. The U.S. and Japan are trying to negotiate a bilateral agreement that will set the stage for Japan becoming a full member of the TPP, and the same old issues that we've seen in the past, automobiles, agricultural products, things like rice and beef and pork, very difficult for the Japanese to give up their protection and lower duties. They are making progress, but it's very slow. So Japan is one issue. Another issue is that of state-owned enterprises, a new issue for trade negotiations. A lot of concern about China and how their various organizations, their SOEs as they're called, are going to be able to compete in the global marketplace. even though China is not a member of the TPP, the rules that are set there will have some effect on them down the road. Also, IPR issues, I know near and dear to your heart, as well as general reduction in tariffs and things like pharmaceuticals. All of those are issues yet to be resolved, and at the rate they're going, Deborah, I don't know if they're going to get done by the end of this year.
Wow. And how about Korea? Is Korea part of these discussions or entering into them?
Yes, good question. Korea is very much interested in joining the TPP. We know that at the last head of state summit with President Obama, Korea said they do have an interest. We are expecting an announcement from them shortly. The expectation is that they will, in fact, join. It's a change of position for them. They thought they had everything they needed with respect to the U.S.-Korea Free Trade Agreement that was completed 2 years ago. But now that they see Japan coming into the talks, they want to make sure they're not being left out. So Korea is now coming in, and that makes this TPP agreement all the more important if and when it's finalized.
Intriguing, very intriguing. And now changing to the next acronym, the
yes.
TTIP front.
Right.
What's going on there?
TTIP, which is a very awkward acronym for the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, which is itself an awkward term for what is simply the U.S.-European free trade talks. Those just kicked off last year, so we're a little bit behind as far as comparison to the TPP. The next round, next week, over the river in Arlington, Virginia. Again, not high expectations. A lot of issues concerning data privacy. You've seen the news, what's going on in Europe. I caught the end of your discussion with Norma on cybersecurity. Those issues are also showing up in the U.S.-EU talks, as well as things like GMO foods, genetically modified organism food. That's a big concern in Europe. So, and then the broader issue of regulatory coherence. How do you get all these complex regulations in the United States and equally complex regulations in the EU on a variety of sectors harmonized? That's easy to say, but very difficult to do. So, this will be a session where they probably make some progress on some simpler issues like tariff reduction.
Interesting. And is this situation impacted by the Ukraine-Russia situation, or is that just a whole separate, ball of wax and
yeah, it, area? Right now, Deborah, it seems to be on a separate track. Now, keep in mind, whenever you're talking about the Ukraine and that part of the world, a lot of those countries are still trying to get into the WTO, like Kazakhstan, for example. So the broader foreign policy issues, I think, are sort of background music for these talks. But so far, with respect to sanctions, it has not had a direct impact on the progress of the U.S.-EU trade talks for the time being. That, however, as you know, could change as developments change in the Ukraine.
Yeah. Speaking of the WTO, I noted that there are some issues relating to trade in environmental goods that implicate the WTO negotiations. And could you explain what those are and what kind of environmental goods we're talking about?
Sure, Deborah. Everything we've been talking about, these various trade negotiations, are outside the jurisdiction of the WTO. These are, after all, bilateral and regional talks. They're not multilateral that are supposed to take place in the context of the WTO. So, politically, the WTO feels they're a little bit on the sidelines. They need to get re-engaged. So, they do have something now, which I think is quite worthwhile, and it has to do with new talks on environmental goods. It's what we call a plurilateral talk. That is, not every member of the WTO has to join it. You join on your own free will. But the U.S. is a participating country. There are 13 others, including China, the EU, Australia, Japan. So it's about 86% of the total global trade in what we call environmental products. And what these talks aim to do is reduce tariffs on those products. The definitions still are yet to be worked out, but as a beginning point, Deborah, they're talking about 54 specific items, everything from wind turbines, solar panels, wastewater treatment technology, air pollution control equipment, all of those things will now be hopefully reduced or have tariffs eliminated to make trade easier on a global basis.
Is there one of the reasons for that the increased concern about climate change and all other, you know, kinds of conservation issues?
Yes, exactly. So the theory behind these talks is that this area is important enough, particularly with respect to what's going on to climate change, that we certainly don't need to have trade barriers and tariff barriers impeding the worldwide movement of goods that are designed to address the broader environmental problem. So, again, these talks were just announced. USTR published a Federal Register notice at the end of March. The first hearing by the International Trade Commission was yesterday. They're going to have another hearing later this summer. So this one is brand new. It's just getting kicked off, and it's an interesting one to keep an eye on, and still plenty of time for interested parties to get involved.
And are these kinds of issues also ones that are at the heart of the Asia-Pacific economic cooperation discussions?
Yeah, climate change generally, as you know, Deborah, is being discussed in the context of APEC. This all gets to be a very convoluted and complicated web, trying to keep track of the items and the fora for discussion and the individual agreements. But yes, APEC, because China now is such a big energy producer and emitter of carbon dioxide, there's a reason for a broader agreement to try and address these issues in the context of the WTO. So it'll start there. It'll also come up in the APEC context.
Great. Before we have to go, Frank, how would someone contact you if they have any questions about international trade or any of the developments in these, you know, negotiations and areas that you've been discussing?
Sure. Thank you, Deborah. My email is fsamolis, S-A-M-O-L-I-S, at pattenboggs.com. Phone number is 202-457-5244.
That's great, and I really appreciate your keeping us up to date on all of these very complicated negotiations and developments in the international trade area.
Great. Always a pleasure, Deborah. Look forward to talking to you again soon.
It sounds great. Okay, thank you very much.
And, okay, thanks so much.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hey, out of my way!
Welcome to Washington Gridlock. Patton Boggs legal team can make sense of it all. We know how Washington works. We've been sorting it out for over 50 years. We have what it takes. Straight, unfiltered, Patton Boggs. We deliver the insights you need to stay on top of your game.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs. Straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs. A bipartisan voice with knowledge and over 50 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has over 50 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than 5 decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
Hello, and welcome back to Capital Thinking. I am Deborah Lodge, standing in for Kevin O'Neill, and pleased to welcome Josh Green to our next segment. Josh is a partner in the Patton Boggs D.C. office, where he is deputy chair of our energy and environmental practice. Josh is a former congressional staff member and entrepreneur, and he enjoys assisting clients in achieving their goals before Congress, regulatory agencies, and state and local governments. Josh, also outside of Patton Boggs, is the co-founder and regional director for Cleantech Open Southeast. And we're pleased that Josh is here today to give us some updates on cleantech and environmental issues. So, Josh, first, I noted that the Shaheen-Portman Energy Efficiency Bill did not get to see the light of day in Congress. What happened?
Yes, indeed unfortunate. And Deborah, it's a pleasure to be on the show and be with you this afternoon. So the Shaheen-Portman legislation, as it's more commonly known here, its more formal title is the Energy Savings and Industrial Competitiveness Act. It's a piece of legislation, bipartisan piece of legislation that has been worked on over the course of the last two Congresses that would provide a variety of incentives as well as strengthen federal policy as it relates to both residential, commercial, and industrial energy efficiency. So there are a lot of manufacturers, industrial end users, service companies that were very interested in seeing the legislation pass. It also would have given a boost to the federal government's ability to contract out for additional energy efficiency and energy-related services, thus saving the federal government and taxpayer dollars. Unfortunately, it got bogged down in what is an election year politics relating to the nation's larger energy issues. And those are not insignificant, and there's certainly merit in a lot of those things. But as we have seen here in Washington, unfortunately, there's been a political breakdown between the parties, and as election year politics exacerbates that problem. So in the United States Senate, unfortunately, the piece of legislation was not did not have enough support to overcome a procedural obstacle. And for right now, it's being set aside, and we're hopeful that the legislation could be called up later on this year.
Great. And, you know, aside from that, are there any other legislative measures relating to energy that we can expect to be debated or alive in Congress?
Certainly. There are a number of measures that the House of Representatives have been working on in this Congress, as well as voting on a number of measures related to fossil energy, permitting of oil and gas development on federal lands. They did do a small energy efficiency bill related to appliance standards. There are other measures related to LNG. It's another issue that we've spoken about on Capital Thinking before, but is somewhat ripe. There have been votes on the Keystone XL pipeline, which is an often discussed interstate and really international pipeline that's going to come down from Canada into the middle of the country. So the House has been doing a lot of work on that. The Senate, of course, is a more deliberative body, a slower body, legislatively speaking, and the Shaheen-Portman legislation was really the first opportunity for the Senate to do things on energy. We'll have to see what will happen from this point on. So a lot of attention now is being trained back onto the states, what is happening there and different legislatures and what governors are doing, as well as in the private sector, where there are a lot of activities happening in the energy and environmental complex, both large and small, clean tech, fossil, and a lot of different things. And then finally, a lot of people are also looking at Asia as well as Europe for some other energy-related activities. So I'm not optimistic that there are going to be a lot more issues debated in the United States Congress this year ahead of the elections, but like anything, things can always change in this town depending upon what the polls say.
Indeed, indeed. And, you know, you mentioned clean tech, and I would like to discuss, you know, what is going on in that segment a little bit more. I note that, you know, you are the Southeast Regional Director for Clean Tech Open, and there was recently a call for applicants to the Accelerator Program. Could you tell us more about that and what it means?
Sure. Thanks, Deborah. So the Cleantech Open is a nonprofit organization based in Palo Alto, California, and runs the world's largest accelerator program for clean technology startup companies and emerging growth companies. And every year, we have an accelerator class, if you will, and we accept applications from budding entrepreneurs and clean tech companies to come into the program. We recently had an application deadline. We have 8 regions across the United States and are working in 10 countries around the world. So our application deadline for the 2014 Accelerator expired on May 2nd. We are now just about finishing up our screening and evaluation process to see what companies we are going to accept into the Accelerator. And then from there, the companies that are accepted will be part of the programming for the remainder of the year, heading up and until the Cleantech Open's Global Investment Forum, which will happen in November in Palo Alto, where our companies will be not only getting the mentoring and the training and other things that we provide during the year, but they also will be competing for a national grand prize award of $200,000.
Can you give us some examples of companies that have been in the program before? You probably can't talk about current applicants, but just examples of you know, how the program has helped these companies get a foot in the door or...
Sure. So over the course of the lifetime of the Cleantech Open, it's now in year 7, the Cleantech Open Southeast, which I helped co-found, as you alluded to before in the show, is in its 3rd year. But over those 7 years, there have been approximately 865 companies that have come through the Cleantech Open program. Of those companies, 60% are still ongoing viable concerns that have raised just about $900 million in the aggregate in follow-on financing. Some of the companies have not yet gone to the initial public offering and gone public, but there have been a lot of companies that have been acquired by larger corporations, some utilities, some original equipment manufacturers, other service companies. Here locally, one company, Power Assure, actually is a California-based business, but is doing a lot of business here. In the D.C. metropolitan area related to demand response at data centers and server farms. That is a Cleantech Open alumni company. There's another company called Alphabet Energy, which is a very intriguing company that's working on combined heat and power applications for diesel generators and taking waste heat and using that to power on-site power equipment. They're at about $40 million in financing. We have another local company, Micronic Technologies, which is in the water technology filtration business over here in Sterling, Virginia. They've been awarded multiple government grants and now are working with the Department of Defense. So there's a whole host, and I'd certainly love the opportunity to come back and talk about some of these great entrepreneurs and what they're working on. But we're really excited about not only the quality, but the diversity of companies that are coming through. And we're also very positive that clean technology, broadly speaking, is on the way up in terms of investment trends. Took a little black eye a little bit with some of the politics surrounding some decisions here in Washington over the last few years, but we're definitely on the rise and on the uptick.
That would be great. And I think we're running out of time, unfortunately, because I would love to hear more about them. And if people wanted to contact you, Josh, to discuss any of these issues or legislation in general, how would they contact you?
Oh, certainly. You can certainly reach me by phone, 202-457-5204, or my email at jgreen, G-R-E-E-N-E, at pattenbogs.com. And if anyone else is interested in learning more about the Cleantech Open, you can reach me at that number, or you can reach me at jgreen@cleantechopen.org, and I'd be happy to speak about that program as well.
Great. That sounds wonderful. I do know there was one more, O-Power. We want to talk about O-Power and its IPO at some point. You may need to come back to Capital Thinking and discuss that more along with the other things. And I am so delighted that I was able to stand in today for Kevin O'Neill and discuss these wonderful updates and current status of issues in the privacy and data security, international trade, and now, you know, energy and legislation and intriguing initiatives in the entrepreneurial scheme. I appreciate it and hope that you'll all come back to Capital Thinking. Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program, brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.